Welcome to Holistic Matters Podcast. We're part of a continuing series with Mark Blumenthal, the Executive Director and Founder of the American Botanical Council. Mark, thanks again for being with us. This segment of our podcast, we'd like to focus really on botanicals in general and primarily trying to point out and help people better understand when and why do you use herbal medicine, the benefits of herbal medicine in general, and how people can become more comfortable with classification. So probably the majority of people interested in herbs are probably at least familiar with the concept of adaptogens, but there are many other types or groups of herbs that are used. Can you walk us through how you would classify and look at classifications in herbs, and maybe starting with the definition of adaptogen? Right. What is that, and what are examples of adaptogens?
So, how many hours we got on?
Yeah.
First of all, thank you for including me. I really appreciate it, John. Thanks for allowing me to share with your listeners about my perspectives on herbs. Adaptogens, of course, or not of course, because some people don't know the term, although it's becoming increasingly popular, refers to a herb that, or an agent that has the ability to help the organism adapt to different types of non-specific stress. So there's several functional aspects of the definition of adaptogen. First of all, adaptogens tend to be very safe. Very seldom recorded instances of people overdosing on adaptogens or taking too much adaptogen. They tend to be safe, first of all. Secondly, they help reduce different forms of stress, fatigue, etc., and help the organism, I say, adapt to different forms of stress. The term we used to use would be a tonic herb, an herb that is a tonic, something that helps build the ability for the organism to maintain a higher level of wellness. The term adaptogen originally was developed in the late 40s or early 1950s by Soviet pharmacologists who were actually studying ginseng, both the Asian ginseng, the Panax ginseng, and I think later the Eleuthero, what was sometimes called Siberian ginseng, although that term is no longer legal for trade in the United States, the Eleutherococcus senticosus, which is a member of the Araliaceae, or a family, the ginseng family, but is different and distinct chemically and botanically from true Asian ginseng or even the American ginseng. So they were looking at adaptogens originally not only for athletes, but eventually for, in the 50s and 60s, for the Soviet cosmonaut program to help increase cosmonauts' ability to withstand certain stresses that they projected would they be subject to in outer space environment, and outer space meaning in this case maybe a few trips around the Earth at several hundred miles. Adaptogens have not been welcomed or adopted by Western pharmacology. It's still a term that is foreign to pharmacology. It's not taught in pharmacology classes. It's not found, I don't think, in any pharmacology textbook. It's certainly not found in Goodman and Gilman, the classic original, you know, classic one. As a matter of fact, I remember about 20 years ago, maybe, I had written an article at the invitation of a medical journal, a conventional medical journal, on botanicals that might be considered useful for clinical practice. And I had ginseng in there, and I talked about adaptogenic responses and the adaptogenic effects of ginseng, etc. And a peer reviewer rejected the article, and the article was rejected by the journal because I used the term adaptogen, which was not a recognized term in Western medicine and pharmacology. So our astronauts, by the way, use Tang.
Tang, yeah. So, I was going to ask you about that. I don't know. High sugar, that work?
Yeah, right. I think maybe a synthetic orange flavor. Was that even natural? I don't even know. But the point, there kind of gives you a distinction here. The Soviets were using Eleuthero extract, and ours were using Tang. Right. So go figure, I guess. You know. I'm a big believer in adaptogens because of their general safety, and also because I believe that people need to look at health from a perspective of high-level wellness. And part of high-level wellness is increasing the body's ability to function from an immunological perspective, as well as to resist various stressors, including but not limited to fatigue. And adaptogens in general tend to do this. And so I mentioned American and Asian ginseng. I mentioned Eleuthero, which is formerly referred to as Siberian ginseng. Other adaptogens include rhodiola. Rhodiola rosea root extract, or the root itself. This is one that I take on a regular basis. And the research on rhodiola shows fatigue reduction or fatigue resisting activity, as well as, interestingly, an antidepressant activity. There's a number of clinical studies suggesting that rhodiola can work as a mild antidepressant in mild to moderate cases of depression. Schizandra, Chinese herb, Chinese name means wu wei, which means five tastes, which is interesting because in Chinese traditional medicine, as is the case in Ayurvedic medicine in India traditionally, herbs are classified by their taste and their energetics. In other words, is it hot or cold? Is it damp or moist, etc.? And five tastes, in the case of a schizandra, which is a fruit or berry, can be used as a food in a sense. Because it has five tastes, is believed to be adaptogenic because it goes in all directions, right, so to speak, at least from that perspective. Yeah. You know, Westerners look at it more from a chemical and pharmacology perspective. Other adaptogens would include the classic adaptogen in India, ashwagandha, which has become increasingly popular and now starting to rank in the top 20 or top 40 best-selling herbs in North America in the natural products marketplace. I believe top 40 herbs now because of marketing from various companies selling ashwagandha and because of the increased amount of clinical trials coming out supporting its various benefits. So there's a number of these plants, but they all seem to have similar types of properties that I already defined based on the original Soviet work by Breckman, Dardamoff, etc. in the early 1950s.
So quick question on that, on adaptogenic approach. You know, in the integrative and functional medicine worlds in particular, there's a lot of discussion, you know, really over the last 10 years, 15 years, on underlying system support. Would you think that these adaptogens may have that kind of benefit of kind of a longer term, you know, adapt to specific conditions because of that underlying systems that are affected rather than a simple target of some mechanism?
Well, presumably. I'm not a pharmacologist and I don't read a lot of pharmacology research because I can't keep up with the clinical data, to be honest with you. But, you know, there are data that suggest that, yes, they do deal with various types of systems as well as hormone levels as well. There are all kinds of ways adaptogens work. One way of looking at it is the effect on heat shock proteins, to mention systems approach. There's been some research on, I think, rhodiola and its effect on heat shock proteins, research being done in Texas, I believe, and reported in various journals. So they are looking at various details as to how adaptogens are working on a system level, etc. And at the end of the day, the research continues to support the idea that these things are quite safe, which is the first concern always. Right. And of course, the fact that you have history of use supporting, I'd like to say confirming, but you know, toxicologists don't like to use historical use as a way of confirming safety because they believe that, well, there's other forms of cryptic hepatotoxicity, other kinds of things. But that doesn't seem to be the case with adaptogenic herbs at all. So that seems to be, I think the historical record is one rational piece of evidence that one cannot ignore assessing their safety.
So after adaptogens?
Well, first of all, there's external and there's internal. So let's just start, I think that people probably first started using plants externally, and maybe for burns or cuts or whatever, as they use, like putting mud on a wound. So I think from an external point of view, one of my favorite herbs is aloe vera. Right. And I believe that everyone should have an aloe vera plant growing in their garden or in a pot on their patio that they can bring in during the winter, because the gel from the aloe vera plant directly for a minor kitchen burn or a sunburn or for a small cut or is just makes so much sense. And you really, you know, it's one of the best herbs that you can really show somebody that herbs do have a pharmacological effect and certain benefits.
Yeah.
Because by adding aloe to aloe gel to a cut, it gives almost immediate relief. So for the naysayers who say these things don't work, you know, start with aloe, and starting with A, it makes a lot of sense. Internally, I think, you know, there's a lot of ways to classify. I think one of the ways that people probably used herbs initially, internally, was probably for digestive upset. There are a number of herbs that are useful for helping ameliorate bloating, gas, digestive upset. Many of the herbs that contain volatile oils, essential oils, the mints being one of them.
Right.
The herbs in the carrot family, like dill, fennel, for just to name two of them, anise, that are typical carminatives, where they basically these essential oils in there actually help increase peristalsis and help relieve gas and bloating. These are common herbs that are so common that the idea of the after-dinner mint has its origin in that social and historical awareness that people even forgot.
Yeah.
You know, that after-dinner mints are there because people used to chew a mint leaf or drink some mint tea after dinner, especially if it's a rich dinner. So, and of course, I mentioned the carrot family. One has to be careful because a number of plants in the carrot family can be quite toxic, and people have to make sure that they identify their plants. Always, always be sure that you know which plant you're taking, whether you're picking it out of the garden, where hopefully you've controlled, you know, you've got better control, but not when you're going out in the forest or out on a Sunday afternoon walk, and when you see a plant, if you don't know and you're not sure what it is, when in doubt, don't. Yes,
yeah, right.
Especially in that carrot family. That's where hemlock is in the same family. You don't want that. And of course, it's pretty easy to tell for some people. Not so easy for others to tell. A lot of different opportunities. Plants have anti-inflammatory activity. And of course, one of the reasons that turmeric is now for the fifth year in a row the top-selling herb in the natural food and the natural products sector is because of either turmeric. And or its extracts that are curcumin-rich extracts for its anti-inflammatory effects, as well as a host of other potential benefits that are being documented by a variety of clinical trials that are coming out. Turmeric and turmeric-based formulations, which include sometimes ginger, which is in the same family with turmeric, for anti-inflammatory effect and or pain-relieving effects for cases of rheumatoid arthritis, in some cases even osteoarthritis. So there's a great deal of data supporting the anti-inflammatory effects. And turmeric is like number one. Boswellia, which is another herb, which is popular, used in formulations for, again, its anti-inflammatory effects and pain-relieving effects for joints. Now, one herb that I think is interesting, there's been maybe 30, 35, 36 studies altogether on certain kind of rosehip and rosehip extract. Mm-hmm. Primarily, actually, the whole rosehip. It's a certain type of rosehip that comes from Denmark, a certain island, I think they call Langeland Island, and helping for osteoarthritis of knee, hip, I think wrist and neck, reducing pain, increasing range of motion, etc. And this is from something like rosehip that we put into vitamin C for children. This is actually a food. It's a form of a traditional food. And I think it's real interesting. When we talk about turmeric, we talk about ginger. And over here, we have rosehips over here. And there's a number of other ones we can talk about and mention. Many of these are historically foods and spices.
Right.
As well as being used as medicines. And there's one of the things that's about herbs that is so interesting and fascinating is that many of them are foods and spices and medicines all in one, or depending on how they're prepared, depending on the dosage form, if you will, and how they're prepared. So you have a automatic presumption of their presumed safety, because you have a history of food use, and in which case, depending on the dosage you take, you probably don't really overdose, although theoretically you could overdose on anything. You can take too much water. Even water can be toxic.
Mark, one of the things that you've mentioned is you know, a handful of different spices and herbs and foods, and many of them may have some overlap in say, benefits. I mean, for example, if you listed Boswellia, turmeric, even rose hips, and they may all be associated to control, if you will, of inflammation or pain and inflammation. Where can the practitioner go to better understand, well, okay, if they all do similar things,